Welcome to the Frog Logic Podcast. I'm your disappearing host, David Rutherford. I want to apologize. I've been gone for a while, and many of you have been reaching out constantly, asking where I've been, what's going on, and more importantly, am I all right? And so to all of you out there who've shown so much concern about my well-being, I appreciate that more than you can imagine. I'm grateful for your love and your support, and I'm sorry I've been gone. The reason I left for a little bit is because I had really kind of lost the inspiration to get on, to produce content, to try and be positive on a regular and reoccurring basis for all of you and for all my followers and customers and clients. As you probably already know or don't know, I stopped using social media when I was locked out of everything a year ago around this time, locked out of Instagram, essentially Facebook, saying my website was against community standards and guidelines. And after 400 plus requests, never heard a single thing back, up to including several people reaching out and asking directly to people they knew at Facebook. Finally had somebody who was working there through a friend look in. They were able to give no clear explanation other than he might have been hacked. And then when they gave me my new credentials to get in, they would not let me log on as long as I had a VPN on and going. So that was the catalyst. That was the beginning for this long stretch of de-inspiration, we'll call it, demotivation. And then over that time, I grew so tired of the hatred that is being thrown around left and right, back and forth in every which way. I'm growing tired of the division that has become the norm within our country, fueled by perpetual lies. It's been devastating to me emotionally, to my mental health, as well as many other people around the country. And you look at the statistics of over 85,000 suicides last year. Some reports have it as high as 93,000 suicides last year. But yet nobody's covering that number. The Wall Street Journal has done some pretty amazing articles on children and their uptick in emergency room visits, in particular for teenage girls, 13 to 17, in some places like Oakland, up over 100 some odd plus percent. Children caving in all the time. I'm hit up regularly by friends and family members of people who are saying to me, I don't know what's going on with my child. They're miserable. They're hurting. How do I get them out of this funk? Much less the rise of alcoholism and addictions. The rise of unemployment, 10.5 million jobs still available out there, but people just refuse to go back to work, partially because of a lot of what they're being paid to stay home. But in other cases, they're just afraid to go back to work. They're afraid to live their lives. And all that led up, I did a couple interviews earlier in the summer that I still have and that I'm going to release starting now. And if you want to, a lot of my stuff I'm only going to release on newsletter from now on. Through my newsletter, you'll be able to reach these links to not only some blog entries, but, some thoughts, some daily doses, my shows. Videos that I'll be doing, they'll only be available through my newsletter from now on. I'm not going to participate in this assault on free speech anymore. And we do have something in the works. We are working on something that hopefully comes to fruition in the next couple months. where we can be able to put out Frog Logic content unrestricted, ungoverned, and free to all those people who are dedicated towards improving their motivational performance abilities, to improving the way their outlook, their positivity on life, and also to give them tools, courses, actual courses to help you defeat the negative insurgency, which is now growing at an alarming rate in ways I could have never dreamed of before. So I moved into this space where I was very low and just not doing all right. And this summer, things started to turn around for me and some positivity in terms of getting back and speaking and working with some companies. And it really kind of brought me back a little bit. I had some business. I was able to go out and make some money and earn some money for my family. And then I started to pay close attention to Afghanistan, a place that had pretty much dominated a decade of my life, a place that has dominated 20 years of heartache and sorrow and pride and honor, a place that has changed the lives of so many of my friends and fellow teammates, people I worked with and all the different capacities with which I worked within serving this government, a government, by the way, that needed us, that called upon us after the atrocities of 9/11. A date that seems to pay almost no mind to the future, this modern generation, a date that is some silent moment in our history that pays no relevance to what we're facing today. People have forgotten that day. They've forgotten what it takes to keep a country safe after we've been assaulted. And I'm here to remind you, from my perspective, what Afghanistan was. Unfortunately, how Afghanistan is. And it almost seems like I, over the last month or so, I witnessed the obituary of my generation, my fellow teammates, my fellow patriots, my fellow warriors. I witnessed the obituary of a generation that is taking place in front of my eyes. And there is no reluctance or sorrow, it seems, to be imbued in the decisions that are being made at the highest levels in our country right now. And I don't understand why. I don't understand why that, starting with Mike Spann, the Central Intelligence paramilitary case officer that was the first person to die in Afghanistan in 2001, where he was interrogating Taliban prisoners at a prison. There was a prison uprising where he was killed. All the way up till just a few weeks ago, when 13 Marines and one Navy corpsman lost their lives, including two female Marines, two daughters of America. And as I look at their faces online and I look at their portraits of themselves and their uniforms and the pride, especially the one young woman who was carrying the child just the day before she was blown up by a murderous Taliban-accepted individual, an Islamic radical hell-bent on creating chaos and death and destruction, not our allies in any way, shape, or form. And I can only imagine what it must have been like for her family when the remains of her corpse came home. So that's one hell of a span. That's 20 years. You know, this was once a pretty courageous thing that people would invest in. I know it inspired a generation of people to Roger up, to quit what they were doing, to make meaning of their lives, to drop out of wherever they were, whatever they were engaged with, and to serve their country in order to protect it for the absolute tyranny of radical ideology. Think about how many young men and women rogered up, volunteered for the fight. And that courageous spirit has literally been dismantled in front of our eyes for nothing more than pure apathy. Pure apathy against the pride that so many of us had put forth to stabilize the world, to unite around a common cause of sovereignty. And that sovereignty by now, which is in question, which is being deconstructed, which is being used to divide our great nation, and to replace it with an ideology we can only describe as postmodern socialism. I don't understand it. I don't understand how we can even begin to contemplate working with organizations or tribes or groups of people that do not believe in the democratic free republic of American democracy, who are actively pursuing to try and tear it down in ways you cannot even fathom. The enemy is not, nor will it forever not be, our friend. This is something that you have to understand. You have to believe that what you're witnessing is not healthy. It's not healthy for our country. And Afghanistan, 20 years we have invested trillions and trillions of dollars into this fight that has literally been whittled down into a catastrophic geostrategic failure. Pure and simple. Now, I've spent about a month trying to wrap my mind around all of this, trying to understand why it's all so painful for me, other than the catastrophic loss of life that I've had to experience as a result of combat deaths of my friends and teammates, along with the catastrophic loss of life from operator syndrome and suicide, the catastrophic destruction of families, divorces, children, operators, and their inability to adapt to modern society because we, this country, multiple administrations, asked them to sacrifice everything. For what purpose? What was the reason? And at some point, you should be asking yourself this very question. And if you get the opportunity, you should ask those who were in charge of the effort that they asked us, not them, as they sat in their offices and think tanks and places around the country, never once setting foot on the battlefield, never once placing themselves in harm's way other than for a photo op at most, but yet asking me and my brothers and sisters in arms to fight the long war. Afghanistan, the horror, the horror. Man, as I sit back and I reflect on so much of what's happening in this world and, you know, and having gone through 9/11, I really began to think about what life was like prior to 9/11. Now, I had joined the military in 1995 after dropping out of college, trying to find myself to replace or rehabilitate my ability to embrace fear, to forge myself confidence, to join a team that ultimately would show me the ultimate purpose in life. And man, it was the greatest decision I could have ever made. It took me out of the abyss of my own lack of potential, or my own perception of my own potential. And it restructured the actual reality that I faced every day and dismembered the self-imposed limitations that I had placed upon myself and rebuilt me around this community, this culture, this brotherhood. Now, prior to 9/11, not a lot going on in the world. Not a lot at all. In fact, there was very few people that I even got close to are participating in anything of substantial, at least within the vanilla teams. I'm sure DevGru and the Tier 1 units were all doing meaningful operations, but we were very few and far between. In fact, most of what we were engaged in was FID. My first deployment overseas was all FID, foreign internal defense, and training people and essentially just having fun overseas. But then 9/11 happened. You know, and at that point, I was over at SQT as an instructor, and I remember the day it happened, and we were in a combat swimmer dive supervisor course in San Diego, and when it went down, and you know, we kept training all the way through, and that weekend we moved out to our training facility out at Nylon, and I used to give the big hoorah speeches before we'd begin IAD training. Immediate action drills, but this day I didn't have much to say other than, all right, gentlemen, this is real now. And you think about that contemplation. Here you are prior to 9/11, and you're still risking your life. You're still deploying. You're still jumping out of airplanes. You're still doing high-risk things. But there was no guarantee of confronting the enemy in any real capacity at that moment. But now it became real. The actuality of our potential unfolded in that tragic day. Not to be denied, not to be ignored, not to be passed over, glossed over. Nothing to see here. Look at this over here. Don't look at that. We were forced. We were thrust into second largest attack on our country in modern history. We were thrust into this fight. I remember the pride that I felt because I was a part of the SEAL community and we were going to get out there and we were going to do some great work. And I remember saying to those young men, me too, I was just a baby as well too, little one platoon wonder teaching. Didn't know very much at all, but I did feel. I was able to, I think, put those feelings into something that was poignant. And I remember looking at them and saying, hey, look to the left of you, look to the right of you, look behind you, look in front of you. Look in those men's eyes. Because many of those men, many of you aren't going to be here after we get into this fight. So every single thing that you learn, learn it in such a way that it transforms you. It enlightens you. It gives you clarity and purpose and determination in ways you could never have even imagined. And that's what it did. And I remember that feeling that was just rippling through the community. I remember the excitement. I remember running into a friend of mine that had rogered up and was going to deploy with SEAL Team 1. And I remember telling him, hey, there's still an opening in one of these mobility platoons. You should put your name in. And I said, hot damn, I'm going to do that. And I remember the excitement, the pull. There was this magnetism towards getting to the fight. I mean, it was entrenched as deep into my soul as anything I could have imagined. We were living in a consciousness that was so radically different that all of us were having to restructure our perceptions, restructure the way we evaluated life and death. And so I put in a request to become a part, and after having to convince my bosses, the late Bruce Cunningham and the great Mike Liu, they fought for me to be a part of that. Went all the way up to the captain over at Naval Special Warfare. And to his credit, and I thank him still to this day, you know, and the Master Chief over there as well too, thank you, gentlemen, for allowing me to participate in that. It was life-changing. And I was going to go in the fight. And I joined this great group of men I still think about intimately today, men whose lives would be changed as well as mine forever. I was so honored to be a part of that group. And remember, I went over early on the Advon trip, and when I got over there, I remember running into one of the first great heroes of the engagement, a guy by the name of Steph Bass, who was working with the Brits. And when that prison uprising took place, he jumped in there and acted so selflessly, willing to sacrifice his entire life, that he was awarded one of the highest merits of honor from the British. But he had a look in his face, a look that I had never seen before, a look that was telling, a look that was transcendental, if you will. The existential truth had shown its face to him in ways that altered his insights. It altered his insides. That war was brutal and horrific and harsh. It was around that time, too, we also lost the first Navy SEAL in Afghanistan, Neil Roberts, Roberts Ridge. After that incident, or during that incident, another frogman and his heroic actions, along with an Air Force personnel to try and save Neil's life, both of them engaged in a heroicism that is pretty remarkable. Both of them were recipients of the Medal of Honor. And so that was the level of commitment that the SEAL teams were bringing to the fight right off the bat. And I was on the ground. I remember we trained for like 70 days, and then we deployed late May. We hit the ground, and man, my preliminary thoughts and ideas of what would take place were completely what didn't happen. I remember hitting the ground in Bagram, being expecting to have this stack of missions just waiting for us, and we picked which one we wanted to do, and there was an unending group of targets to go after. Nah. This was a fight that was not within the purview of our control, to say the least. It would seem that somebody else was calling the shots, that was dominating the battle space, that had the decision-making abilities to parcel out whatever they wanted. And very quickly came to understand that this was the Central Intelligence Agency's war. They were in control. They controlled the areas of operation. They controlled who was doing what, who was doing it when, and how it would be done. And there were many clear instances where the frustration became pretty overwhelming, where the politics of the geostrategic nature of waging war began to be illuminated. And although I was a young, relatively young a warrior, I turned 30 in Afghanistan that summer, I began to feel pretty small. I began to feel not as if I was some knight on a chessboard taking down opponents, but more like some piece of dirty lint on the bottom of a pawn on a chessboard that had over a million pieces. I remember we had lots of different opportunities based on reconnaissance we had done, but we were essentially shut down because there was a political event happening, the first Loyal Jirga, whatever it was called, and all operations got shut down in order for us to be able to install the government that we thought would be most beneficial us for us to continue this war and to track down Osama bin Laden, which, by the way, by now we realized that the ISI of Pakistan had helped him escape into Pakistan, where he remained for the next 10 years, protected. And that was just the beginning. I remember coming home from that deployment and really questioning myself for a multitude of reasons. Had it been worth it? My performance, still haunting to this day in many cases. The injuries of my friends. Had we been able to do enough? Had I been able to do enough? I just didn't feel that sense of immense and immeasurable pride that I had gone over and we had done great work eradicating the earth from these terrorist savages. I didn't feel that. Now, fast forward, I think, for a multitude of reasons, which I've discussed before on other shows, other places, I decided to punch out, that my time in the military had come to the end. I wasn't experiencing what I had imagined I would have, and perhaps that was my own fault. Most likely it was. So I got out, and over the immediately began to experience the pain of detachment, the identity crisis, the shift. I began to try and manage some post-traumatic stress. I began to try and manage some of the other issues that are affiliated with being a member of the special operations for any particular time. But there was no veterans organizations, there was no support networks, there was no training, there was no real literature or education as to the totality of the effects of war and what it might do to you. I mean, there were books from Vietnam, most certainly, but you know, I didn't go back and really dig into Apocalypse Now and the metaphors within that book or from the original source of Hearts of Darkness and the hunt for Colonel Kurtz and what that is. But I know the hunt was still on for sure. And after having some pretty traumatic emotional experiences when I first got out, I ended up, you know, going to work for Blackwater, which was at the time, you know, the heyday of Blackwater. 2,600 people a day training at the facility in Moyock. There was like, you know, 28 ranges, two driving tracks, an airstrip they were building. They had four kill houses. They had a 65,000 square foot headquarter building. I mean, the place was amazing. And a friend of mine asked me to go on, and I thank you for that invitation, Joe. I hope you're doing all right, buddy. And I jumped in. Unfortunately, I didn't get to go back to Afghanistan right away, but I spent quite amount of time working in Azerbaijan with a maritime interdiction program, a FID program that we were trying to take on board because the regular SEAL teams and other soft units couldn't meet the FID requirements around the world, so we tried to get in there. And after that, wasn't able to continue the full-time employment, so became a contractor and went overseas. And this is where I got the exposure to the complexities of government contracting and what it meant. The amount of money that was involved. What we were engaged in. And for me, I got thrown into the mix as a working with the Afghan counter-drug commandos, mentoring them, teaching them. And then I also agreed to take on a building project where I was a building manager for the Afghan border police facilities in Gardez and Herat, and ran that pretty much by myself, and was recognized that Blackwater essentially was charging the government three bills and paying me for one. But that's kind of how the military-industrial complex works, folks. Something that Ike had warned us about way back when. The profit that you can receive from engaging in sustained warfare is astronomical. If you don't believe me, go check it out. Go look at Dynacor's profits over the last 20 years. Go look at Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Blackwater, Triple Canopy, Sock C. If you want to have a good laugh, go look up a company called Custer Battles and the fiasco they were once Iraq kicked off. What had been discovered is that this war could be fought with limited resources, but high on government contracting. Essentially getting former guys like me and paying them to do the work that otherwise military would work. Because if you don't forget, by the time I went over there again in 05, they had launched Iraq, which had taken most of the resources, most of the focus, most everything. So now all of a sudden you have this lingering space in Afghanistan that nobody's quite sure what to do with because they can't find the people that they intended to originally target, or they intentionally knew where they were, and they thought this would be a great proving ground, a great training ground for operators to get real world life experience out on the hunt in these very difficult terrains. And one of the things that became so illuminating to me is, oh my God, the magnitude of opium that Afghanistan produces and floods into the world's markets. Now, when the Taliban had first come onto place, they restricted the sale of heroin. They held it out, driving prices through the roof. And then right around when I started to work with the DEA FAST teams and the counter-drug commandos and teaching them, kind of exploded again. And in many locations, being distributed across borders freely. And the fact that we knew it was being distributed across borders freely One border in particular, almost 1,600 tons a week of raw opium. Who was controlling that? What were they doing with that? Why were they allowed? Seeing that at one point, profit from drugs attributed for about 90% of Afghanistan's GDP. In fact, Karzai's own brother was one of the biggest drug dealers in the country. Who knew that? Who allowed that? You know, thankfully, though, even though I began to really understand that this was not what it seemed, and only my second trip over there, thankfully, I did have another Afghanistan moment of divine inspiration on my first deployment. Is also a time where I had a pretty substantial, actually, my testimony to God happened on my first trip. And that's another show, another time. My second one, as we were doing this drug hit one time, it seemed to be completely fabricated. We were in this compound and I noticed all these kids, and I've told this story many times, and those kids, I couldn't understand how these children who were ultimately decimated from the moment they were children, who lived in this arcane, disgusting, barbaric society where essentially teenage girls were receptacles for procreation and beaten on a regular basis, not able to gain access to education or anything positive, where young boys were raped and molested on a regular basis, where they were beaten with sticks, where they were living with animals, no education other than being taught the hatred of radical Islam. And on this one particular moment, I saw these children after we had done this raid, and for some reason, I just was overwhelmed by the empathy I needed to have as a human being that exists within the human condition if you allow yourself to search for the good. And you have to search for the good every single day. There's no question about that. The good is not coming to find you. The suffering and the pain will find you. There is no doubt about that. But you must search for the good. And on that particular day, I was inspired to begin Frog Logic, to rechange my course in history. Instead of trying to effectuate real change in the world through the barrel of a gun, I made the decision to try and effectuate change through children around the world. And out of that inspiration, Frog Logic was born, which launched me into writing my first book, which was a kid's book, and to over about 2 years speaking to about 7,000 kids in North America. And I felt rejuvenated. But also around that time, that the summer of 05, right prior to my deployment in the fall of 05, is when Operation Red Wings happened. And I put a lot of those young men through training, in particular Marcus. And I remember being at the embassy in Azerbaijan the day it happened. We found out and being decimated, devastated, destroyed emotionally, that we had just suffered the single greatest loss with the helicopter crash, the single greatest loss in our unit's history since World War II, and the greatest loss in Afghanistan to date, and Iraq. And I had this just deep gut feeling that things were not going as we had hoped, or if they were, they weren't going as they were supposed to be planned. That somehow, somewhere, the strategy, right? The strategy, the essence of with which you wage war, the essence with which you wage your professional endeavors, to have a strategy. It's essential. My father taught me that playing chess with him way back when I was a kid. You must have a strategy, period, plain and simple. But yet it began to completely be evident that there was no strategy. And then that was confirmed in my deployment a few short months after that. So I walked away and decided I was going to try and focus my life, and still more men continued to die. And not only did Afghanistan produce deaths, but Iraq too, which was the subsidiary war of Afghanistan and the war on terror, which at some time, hopefully we'll get the true reasons behind waging war in Iraq. Hopefully. But at that point, what it seemed is just like Captain Willard first ran into Kilgore. Smells like victory. And I think that's what a lot of the senior ranking members of the CIA and the DIA and the FBI and the DOD and JSOC and SOCOM, all these top level people were saying, oh yeah, smells like victory. But also knowing that they had to continue up that river in search for Kurtz, Bin Laden, the chaos of war. And as I began to work with kids, I started having a new lens on how I look through life. And that new lens was completely given to me after the economy collapsed in 2008, which we now know was generated by greed, generated by certain people that have fiscal control wanting more and more and more and more. And so what they do, they devastated the country, which then took me away from the drive of trying to help children. And the only way I could take care of my family at the time was to put my bulletproof vest back on and go teach. And this time I got to go teach for the CIA. And I got to look at life through a new lens. And this lens was pretty remarkable. These people who were going over there, these case officers, these paramilitary case officers, they were going over and they were doing their jobs, spending a year at a time. They were getting to the bottom of it. They were putting themselves in harm's way. They were pushing themselves and overworking themselves and driving themselves. And I met some of the greatest minds that our country, the greatest intellectual warriors our country has ever produced, greatest warriors. And they taught me in a totally new way to look at warfare, to look at the strategy behind things. And it was a powerful, powerful moment for me. And for 2 years, I got to listen and learn. And the deaths kept happening. More and more and more deaths. And the ideas about ROEs and the restrictions. And you can't fight this way. You have to fight that way. And you can't do this and you have to do that. Oh, that's not our business. This is only our purview. This is the space you can operate. You can't do this. And it just kept going and going and going and going. And no matter who pled their case, and no matter what we started to see, because we started to see the suicide numbers rise incredibly. No matter what we screamed or what we did, it kept going on and on. So I decided at that point, it had been about 5 years since I had deployed, and I needed to put my money where my mouth was. I needed to get back in the fight. And so on my third deployment, right before that, I had been involved in a course where I had met an individual who I had pled desperately to listen to their experts in security, their experts in waging war, and the people that would help them overseas. And right prior to my deployment, in the beginning in January of 2010, my third deployment at this point, there was a double agent who blew himself up, killing 8 Central Intelligence Agency operators. And so that was the environment I was deploying into. A catastrophic failure that had got people killed. So that was the environment I was heading back into. 2010, almost 10 years after I had been there the first time. 8 years. And when I showed up, there was this air of, my God, why is nobody listening to the lessons that we learned the hard way? And I remember when I got out to the area where I was supposed to be, I came to rapidly understand that there is no strategy other than to be strategic, to do the mission that they do every day without any concise matter of completing something, of ending something, of getting to a place where that's it, it's over, we've done it, we're there, done, kaput. And also within that deployment, I came to realize that, guess what? Drugs are still a major role in Afghanistan. If you go back and you look at what was going on in West Virginia at the time, there was an utter opioid crisis. To date, it's killed somewhere over 7,000 people, I think. And 700,000, excuse me, I'm sorry to all those who've died from opioid overdoses. And I think we're coming up on that again now with fentanyl. We're going to be seeing a magnitude of suicides and overdoses that you can't even believe. So stand by because of our open borders. So, you know, after 8 years, I got to see behind a curtain and came to realize, man, that there was no real strategy other than to continue to wage war. Continue to keep the machine going. And don't get me wrong. I have friends that did some incredible things. Some friends that have over 400 combat missions. Some that have close to 1,000 combat missions. When you think about what it means in your life, if you didn't have a strategy for your life, what would that do to you? If you just lived in a perpetual state of fear, if you just lived in a perpetual state of intoxication, if you just lived in this state where you couldn't focus on what was actually happening, and chances are you'd make some pretty bad decisions. Now, after that deployment, because of what I was feeling and seeing, you know, we decided I moved my family up to North Carolina. And the idea was that we would get a farm and live out in the middle of nowhere. And we would distance ourselves from what I interpreted to be the corruption of so many different things, you know, the stressors that were happening within the world, within my mind, especially that, man, things aren't what they seem. Now, before my fourth deployment back to Afghanistan, a few months after that last one, I had one of the greatest experiences of my life. My first daughter was about ready to be born, and I had done a considerable amount of work at developing a strategy of my faith, and that I had decided to become a true Christian, to be born again under the blanket, the veil, under the love, under the armor of God and Christ. And so I got baptized before that next one because I had this feeling that if I were to perish because of the inconsistencies I saw to be the strategic initiators, if you will, I wanted to make sure I was right with God and that my child would be born knowing that I was a man of faith. And when I got back overseas, this was right after the big Marja offensive. This was right after, the big push to bring back some focus to Afghanistan and particular central regions because it had gotten out of control again. And I watched, and I'll never forget, there was a gentleman that was on the base that I was working with whose son was deployed in the same region. And while we were out there, his son had essentially almost gotten blown up. Because what was going on is the ROEs were so restrictive that they were forcing Marines to do overt daytime patrols instead of at night. And after every patrol, the Taliban would come back in and they would essentially redeploy the IEDs along the pathways and around the villages and around the compounds. And dead Marines seemed to become the consistent thing that we were seeing. Now, thankfully, they released the special operations and JSOC in particular to really go out and to go after the enemy in the Raoul River Valley along the border. And it got so impressive that at one point, Karzai was requesting from our government that they stop nighttime raids. Because when you allow us, the operators, the dedicated, those who are sworn to defend the Constitution against the tyranny that exists externally and internally, we get the job done. And that could be why they put so many rules on us. Our own government employing rules on us, rules of engagement that actually hampered our ability to wage war and killed Marines. I'm still waiting for somebody to explain that to me. Still waiting for somebody to explain how when you put rules in war and you give the enemy the advantage, how victory is possible at all. It defies logic. It defies the entirety of military history. But yet, we did it. Now, you know, that deployment was the last time I was deployed to Afghanistan. But I didn't stop deploying. I shifted my area of operation and went into Pakistan the following year. And I felt like this time I was really going upriver. I was going to be able to get to the source to finally find where Colonel Kurtz was located. Really to walk that razor's edge. And it felt like that, to be sure. We were under duress in ways you can't even imagine, operating in ways that would shake anybody up. But we did it. And we did it because we knew there was a deeper and more significant meaning. And what was interesting is during that time, if you go back and you look at those years of drone strikes, that we were executing more drone strikes in foreign countries than ever before in history. drone strikes against the enemy, foreign and domestic. And again, it seemed like, what was the strategy? Now, I'll tell you, after my first deployment, I came home and things were very complicated overseas at that time. And before I went back, we got bin Laden. I shouldn't say we, I should say my teammates, my brothers, all those incredible mugs over at Damnik, all those incredible case officers and PMCOs that invested their time, thousands and thousands and thousands of man hours hunting down bin Laden. And we got him. I remember I went back, I was on the ground a couple weeks afterwards and thought for sure, all right, this is great. The whole strategy will change and they'll start to get us out of there and we'll start winding down and we'll start tapering out the mission, because what we had set out to do was to eradicate the world of Al-Qaeda and the senior leadership, that we were good, we were done, and that would be the end. Now, fast forward, I did one more deployment after that summer deployment and ends up, due to some pretty substantial hacking that took place around that time, there was one of the largest hacks in modern U.S. history, still to this day, that seems a little bit shady, where much of people that possessed top secret clearances of some kind or another was exposed. And as a result, we had to leave the country. Now, you know, for me, it ultimately came to an end. I decided that that was it. I had done what I needed to do, and I felt compelled to hang it up at that moment. We had achieved the death of bin Laden, and it was good, and we would be done now. But I was wrong. Although I had hung it up, my friends were still invested. They were still going, because now the hunt for terrorism had spread all over the country, all over the Middle East, all over Africa. And we had expanded these covert wars in ways that you can't even dream of. And what happened? Because of a lack of strategy, I believe. Well, that following year, Extortion 17, 22 team guys from Dev Group getting shot down in a helicopter along with a dog and other Afghans going to save a bunch of their buddies who were in a tick. Think about that loss. It was the greatest loss of life that we've had in the last 20 years. Our greatest operators, the most elite human beings, elite warriors on the planet, got shot out of the sky in a war that seemed to have no purpose. And if you talk to the men that were a part of that organization, and those were their close personal friends, I knew a few of them, to this day they are still devastated by that, wondering why. Why did it happen? Why were they still there? What were they doing? Now, don't get me wrong, almost everybody I've ever met that's been to war once, twice, 100 times, 200 operations, 300, 400, 500 military operations, soft guys, they don't stop. Once you get us focused and we have a commitment, we have a purpose, which is to wage war on the battlefield, to get the job done, to kill bad guys, they will not quit. And right a little bit after that, on September 11th, I lost two more friends in Benghazi. Now, why were we in Benghazi? What were we doing there? Why did we have personnel there? What had happened? What was going on? What had happened to Gaddafi? How did we get Gaddafi out of power? Was there an arms agreement? What was happening? Were there cries that, hey, the security situation on the ground was decimated? All these questions really haven't ever been fulfilled, truly answered by any administration or government yet. But what I do know from my other brothers who were there, the outcome wasn't exactly the most honorable, other than the fact that they fought tooth and nail to save the lives of all those who needed saving. And they did. 30-plus people saved their lives. So I thank you to all my brothers that were there, guys that I had worked with just recently in the past and long past. And I say thank you to the effort that you put forth in this expanded war. But in that moment, I really truly began to understand who actually matters and who doesn't. And that was kind of the coup de grace for my mental assessment, my cognitive assessment of how we're valued. And what role we play in this expansion. This expansion of power. You know, I have to admit that after 2012, you know, my faith was pretty beaten up. Thankfully for me, I decided to end my service to the nation, and I recommitted my efforts towards Frog Logic, and over the next 10 years really built up my brand and putting an effort forth to bring positivity to the world, to say, hey, don't lose faith. And I just kept thinking about, man, what's happening around us? And I started to see all the residual effects in my friends and how it was destroying their lives, the long-term commitment to fighting endless wars. I kept thinking to myself, man, as I was reflecting upon this metaphor of apocalypse now, and what was still going on, my brother's doing deployment after deployment after deployment, I kept thinking to myself, man, never get out of the fucking boat. Remember what Chef says, never get out of the fucking boat. But they did. My brothers, they kept getting out of the boat again and again and again in search for the elusive, mysterious Colonel Kurtz, that mythical enemy that potentially could be one of our own. And I began to see my struggling brothers. And so I wanted to act. I wanted to continue serving them now, not the government, the endless wars, but to serve my brothers. Because what you saw was this explosion. There was so much money to be made. Dollars for the dead, if you will. Up to at one point, I think there was like 46,000 veterans charities. And I remember raising a lot of money for a lot of these charities. And all, you know, God bless them. All the people that I had the opportunity to work for, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. It was a true privilege and honor. And you, all of you have done really great work in your efforts. But because of the drunken, addicted death that was riddled our community and all the other communities, most especially the special operations groups, I began to recognize that the long war in Afghanistan would have ripples of Kipling in ways I just couldn't have fathomed. You think about the way empires have been broken, a across the spine of the Hindu Kush. Empire after empire, broken spirits after broken spirits. If you want to look up some interesting thing, man, go look at how many casualties the Russians had, what it did to society, their society, and the defeat, the moral defeat. And if you don't believe me, go back and do some research. Look at the moral defeat of the British and the moral defeat of the early Russians. The moral defeat of any of those who come across the Afghanistan wasteland of war. But they kept insisting that we got to hold that line. Keep them on the line. Keep them going more and more and more and more. Keep them on the line. It's so funny with whatever type of political move, and we pulled out early in Iraq, what happened? Kafka's war ensued. The metamorphosis of Al-Qaeda, the resistance, into ISIS, which launched an entirely new industrial complex endeavor. And we saw the next generation start to launch and deploy into those areas. In fact, for me, it became an immense personal thing. Somebody I had invested a tremendous amount of time, a truly great man, I found him on the battlefield, on the front lines, back in the face, out there with men that I had fought with, still fighting. And I wondered to myself, Rut, is he even fighting for the same thing I fought for? Does he even know why he's over there? What is the purpose of him risking his life? What is the strategy? Because I couldn't decipher it at that time, but at least he was fulfilling a dream. Because what I was seeing was the new war. A new war at home. Now, when I first started Team Never Quit podcast with Marcus, man, it was just, we had so many brothers that were struggling. And at one point, I was going through my divorce, and one of my brothers introduced me to a man who really started to fill in the truth of what was taking place. And the doctor was in. And that's when I met Dr. Chris Free. And as he began to help me understand the savagery of waging endless war and the effects it has, both effect and affect, on the human spirit, I began to recognize that it's so much bigger than you could possibly even fathom. The battle never ends. It rages on through traumatic brain injury, endocrine dysfunction, sleep apnea, orthopedic issues, intestinal problems, isolationist, fear, worry, rumination, lack of emotional intelligence, and on and on and on. And the new battle that so many of my brothers in arms who've waged the war for 20 plus years are now facing is the battle against operator syndrome. If you want to know more, please visit my website at teamfroglogic.com and download it there. You'll understand as to the magnitude of medical and mental health issues ravaging operators across our country, great country now. And I think to myself when I watch that great monologue by Colonel Kurtz, by Marlon Brando, one of the greatest performances ever, and he talks about the razor's edge. And it's obvious that he had lost his perception of reality, actual reality, and he'd moved into a world where the ideas that he sought to pursue had detached themselves from morality. At least morality in his own mind, the natural order of how we have turned chaos into order over the millennia. And these belief systems which have shaped American life and society. And in the midst of all of my friends crashing in, what I started to see was a looming amnesia, where our country was forgetting the effort that had been made. And as it continued to grow, as the new war began to prevail, I started to recognize, man, maybe now we're the new enemy. Maybe we're the enemy because we now know the truth. We now know the truth of endless wars. You know, one of the things that I began to think about as I watched the Afghanistan debacle take place, and knowing that they knew and they did it anyways, I just kept thinking to myself, those final scenes, this is the end. Beautiful friends, the end. And all of that imagery and the connotations and the sacrifice of the water buffalo. And Kurtz knowing that his time had to come because he had absolutely detached himself from any sense of true morality. His moral relativism had usurped his restraint and he'd become just a killing machine, destroying anything in his past for the sole purpose of his own convictions. They knew it and they did it anyways. All you got to do is look at the timeline, folks. Look at what happened. Look at what they were saying to us and what was actually happening. Look at what they knew and what they did anyways. And look at what it resulted from their actions. Young kids, the second generation of the endless wars, were murdered in cold blood, trying to help, not leave people behind. Doing what they were taught, even though that they were under attack internally, to flush out all those who could be interpreted as radicals, who could be interpreted as extremists, purging our own ranks in the face of the savage rebellion, the uprising from the people that 20 years ago we went to war against. 20 years later, we're funding them and arming them so that we can fight them again sometimes in perhaps another 20-year war. I guess we should change the motif as to always leaving men behind and women and kids and aid workers and people who assisted us, who helped us do what we did for the last 20 years. We shouldn't worry about them. It was so painful to witness this that I was laden with an emotional storm that I hadn't felt in a long, long time. And although I had this sensation that Afghanistan and the context of the last 20 years and its affinity or of its relevance to 9/11 itself, its connections were now being castrated in the most demoralizing way a human could ever experience it. Or I should say, a warrior who existed for 10 years, committed to it, 20 years committed to watching the devastating nature of its effects on my friends and brothers and the families. and the children. These were dark waters, dark times, my friends. But it would appear that we've headed down a new river. And that we weren't going to get rid of Kurtz. And Kurtz is still alive. He's just picked up and he's moved his contraband army to a new tributary of evil. And I think these dark waters all lead to China. And you can be sure that there are new battle lines being drawn. All you got to do is turn on the TV every single day to start to see where those lines are or aren't, to start to see who is being labeled as the new terrorist, to see who is being labeled as the new attack, the new group that we should attack and engage in a non-strategic and endless war against. Foreign and domestic, I guess. I think one of the great things that we need to evaluate in this metaphor is not so much the insanity, the intellectual superiority and insanity of Kurtz's descent into hell, but more so Captain Willard's, a young idealistic warrior who thought he believed in one thing. And as he got sucked down into the abyss of hell along with Kurtz, he realized what he believed was an actuality. Really there. And so as we go down these rabbit holes, down into this what would seem make-believe world that we are being told exists, it would seem now that the apocalypse with which we once used to wage war, good versus evil, freedom against tyranny, democracy against communism, good versus evil, is now becoming evil versus good. What ideas are picking up steam? How are things being switched? What was right is now wrong. What was wrong is now right. What was up is now down, and what was down is now up. It would seem the dialectics of yesteryear have come back and are asserting the battlefield as we speak. And you can be sure that the war that is coming will never end. As all war never ends. 9/11. 20 years. I'm going to do another show about 9/11. I had the incredible opportunity to go up to New York City on 9/11. Spend some time at Ground Zero with a good friend of mine, very close friend, person I have just profound respect, a true warrior poet. And then went and attended a private dinner with Bernie Kerik and Mayor Giuliani and listened to their incredible stories and the people who were there that day and my reflections of those moments. You'll only be able to kind of get that show on the newsletter. So please, again, don't forget to sign up. Go to froglogicinstitute.com and sign up and you will get that show in the future here in the next week or two. Colonel Kurtz, man, he is a figure that has been a part of my ideas, my consciousness, my interpretation of war since I was 13 years old when I first watched Apocalypse Now. I was infatuated with the movie. I didn't know why. I didn't know what it was. Perhaps it was just the intensity of the duality that exists within all, and how it can be exposed, and how it can be influenced, and how it can be cajoled and manipulated into becoming an ideological nightmare. But there was something about it that just stuck with me. And go figure that I myself would participate in an endless war. And that I myself would feel the effects of a country that seems to have forgotten or is ready to condemn those that fought the war in a manner that is reflective of those same times. A cultural revolution against that which I believe in, that which I support, and that which I was willing to die for, and a lot of my friends did die for. It's funny how the parallels are now taking place so vividly in my own life, making me wonder, what is the apocalypse now for our generation going to look like? Maybe it's something I'll start writing myself. Maybe there's a story in me. Maybe I'll call it Apocalypse Forever. I want to thank everybody that continues to pay attention to me, even though I've been not around a lot. I am still on LinkedIn rarely. I'm going to start doing the show more. I'm going to continue writing more blogs, more daily doses that will only be delivered through the newsletter. So if you're interested and you want to listen, please sign up for the newsletter. If you want to share this with your friends, have them sign up for the newsletter as well, either at teamfroglogic.com or froglogicinstitute.com, or follow me on LinkedIn. We are working on something for the future that will provide greater access to the Frog Logic content, both the daily reminders of positivity and performance in the face of great environmental, external, internal adversities, and then also curriculum that will support you in those times where times are tough, where the suffering and the pain become so unbearable that you feel as if you are going to snap and splinter into a million pieces. I am still wholly committed to helping you reassemble those pieces, to help you understand some tools that I have learned and others have learned that care deeply for you and where you're at now in your life. I have a new perspective now, having again been splintered into a million pieces and reassembled them through the help of people I can't even begin to tell you, my family in particular, my parents and Jonna's parents and my siblings and Jonna's siblings, and just such a remarkable community of support I have, and my friends, my non-military friends. Thank you all so much. But most importantly, my teammates and my brothers, all of you who have seen and watched my struggle going down the dark river of my own interpretation of my own realities. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your help, your phone calls, for lifting me up in the face of adversity. And I hope I was there for you as you contemplated the last 20 years of your life and what its meaning was all about. Because I'll tell you right now, the true meaning was in the deed that you did. Because there is honor imbued in those deeds in ways none of these other people can even remotely begin to experience, understand, or even live out. I want to thank Chris. Thank you for bringing some clarity to the suffering and some hope to the pain. And I know when we release our Operator Syndrome online course, we will begin to help people through the darkness to come back down, back up river to the light. I want to thank my kids for every day inspiring me to be better, a better man, to contextualize the true meaning of life, to compartmentalize my pain and suffering in a way that it doesn't affect them too greatly, for making me realize that love is the answer to all of our problems, for teaching me what life is really about. And I want to thank Jonna. Without you, I couldn't have done it. You are my salvation. You are the strength. You are the armor that I utilize to fight every day. And lastly, I want to thank Christ for teaching me the way. If you doubt it, just go seek it out. Seek the truth. Recognize that God loves you. And if you love yourself, you can love others, even in the face of the great enemy. Christ was persecuted from the beginning, and as we shall be persecuted again and are being persecuted. But through his love and the love of God and the love of your love for your neighbor, your family, your friends, your children, your love, immediate loved ones, your partner. That's the front line. So I hope this reflection has given some insight as to my feelings and my thoughts to help quantify just one man's ability to think back at the last 20 years. To think back at